Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a really significant piece of American legislation, the Affordable Care Act, or, you know, Obamacare.
Right.
Our mission, well, it's pretty straightforward. Get to the heart of where it came from, what it actually does, and maybe its early impact, all based on the information we've looked at.
And you really can't talk about the ACA without acknowledging just how divisive it was, still is in many ways.
Totally.
I mean, it passed Congress with absolutely zero support from one major party. That immediately set the stage for these intense debates that, frankly, went way beyond just health policy specific.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking fundamental ideas, right?
Yeah.
Like what government should do, what it shouldn't.
Exactly. Individual liberty versus collective responsibility, different visions of American society. It touched on all of that.
Yeah, it's more than just a policy. It feels like a political artifact. Shaped by that specific moment, you know.
Definitely. And it's a legal structure that's faced, well, constant challenges.
And a cultural flashpoint, too.
Yeah.
Exposing some really deep tensions.
Precisely. The arguments about its success, its limitations, its future, they're still going strong. But you can't deny its profound effect on healthcare financing, delivery, and, well, how we even think about healthcare in the U.S.
And to really get the ACA, you have to realize it didn't just, like, materialize out of thin air. Okay, let's unpack this. It's really the culmination of, what, over a century of reform attempts?
Yeah, over a century. That history is absolutely key to understanding why it looks the way it does and why it sparked such passionate reactions.
So where does that story even begin?
Well, what's fascinating is the first serious push for national health insurance was way back, progressive era, 1912.
1912, wow.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt running on the Bull Moose platform. He actually proposed social insurance for sickness, unemployment, old age. It was a direct response to the insecurities of, you know, industrialization.
Makes sense. People moving to cities, wage labor. More vulnerability.
Exactly. Vulnerable to things beyond their control.
So it was on the table way back then. What stopped it?
Well, a few things came together. Roosevelt lost the election. That was big. Then World War I shifted everyone's focus.
Right.
Plus, you had opposition from the American Medical Association. They were worried about government interference.
Always a factor.
And later, you know, during the Red Scare, government health insurance got linked with socialism. That really stigmatized it.
Ah, the socialism label. A recurring theme, maybe.
Definitely a recurring theme. Anxiety about government getting involved in what felt like a private matter.
Okay, so fast forward a bit. Great Depression. Huge economic crisis. Surely that created another window.
It did. FDR, he actually thought about including health insurance in the Social Security Act.
Who didn't? Right.
Right. His advisors worried it was too contentious. It might sink the whole Social Security package, which was already facing pushback. So it was strategic, prioritized the broader safety net first. The idea didn't vanish, but, you know, back burner.
Okay, so the idea keeps bubbling up. Now let's jump way forward, right before the ACA. What did things look like in the late 2000s?
Oh, it was a mess, a real patchwork system. In 2008, you had, what, 46.3 million Americans, 15.4% of the population with no health insurance at all.
That's just a huge number. Yeah. Who are these people mostly?
Disproportionately lower income, young adults, minorities, people working for small businesses. But here's the thing. Most were U.S. citizens. Most lived in families with at least one full-time worker. It wasn't just the unemployed.
Right. That's a key point. People working, but still no coverage.
Mm.
And the financial strain.
Yeah.
Even for those with insurance.
Oh, that's where it gets really stark. Having insurance wasn't like a guarantee against financial ruin. A 2007 study found medical bills contributed to, get this, 62% of personal bankruptcies.
62%.
Yeah. And even more shocking, 78% of those people actually had health insurance when they first got sick.
Wait, they had insurance and still went bankrupt for medical bills.
Exactly. It shines a huge spotlight on underinsurance, right? High deductibles, big copays, coverage caps, policies that just didn't protect people from massive costs.
So it wasn't just about being uninsured, it was also about having insurance that just wasn't good enough.
Precisely. Inadequate coverage was a massive problem.
So, okay, the uninsured faced huge barriers, but even the insured were vulnerable. What did being uninsured actually mean for people's health?
It often meant delaying care, putting off doctor visits until things got really serious, acute. That leads to worse outcomes, obviously, and ironically, higher costs down the line when they finally need emergency care.
Makes sense. Avoidable problems become crises.
And tragically, a 2009 Harvard study estimated nearly 45,000 deaths a year were linked to lack of insurance.
45,000 deaths?
Yeah.
every year.
Yeah. Made it a leading cause of death for working age Americans. It's a truly shocking number.
Just staggering.
Yeah.
And the safety net that existed?
Yeah.
How was it holding up?
Well, things like public hospitals, community health centers,
yeah.
charity care, they were incredibly strained. And it was uneven, you know, different depending on where you lived.
Right.
Emergency rooms, which have to treat everyone by law, basically became the default primary care for a lot of uninsured folks.
Which is super inefficient. Right. And expensive.
The most expensive way to get basic care, essentially.
So beyond just access, what about the system itself?
Mm.
How healthcare was delivered, paid for?
Mm.
What were the underlying weaknesses there?
Oh, plenty. The dominant fee-for-service model was a big one. It basically paid providers for doing more stuff, not necessarily for making people healthier.
Right, quantity over quality.
Leads to overutilization.
Yeah.
And care was often really fragmented, you know, specialists not talking to each other, duplicated tests, poor coordination, especially for chronic conditions.
Yeah, happy to see that.
Plus, you had a lot of market concentration hospitals, insurers reducing competition, keeping prices high, and the whole system was tilted towards treating sickness, not preventing it.
So it sounds like by, say, 2008, 2009, there was this widespread feeling that the system was just broken.
Yeah.
What was the public mood?
Yeah, concern was definitely at a boiling point. Polls consistently showed healthcare costs and access were top worries for families. Even with the recession hitting, a Kaiser poll in September 2009 found 57% thought reform was more important than ever.
That's pretty telling, even during a recession.
It shows you how urgent it felt to people.
But there must have been anxiety too, right? People who had insurance maybe liked their plan.
Oh, absolutely. That was the tightrope. Many insured people saw the system problem, sure, but they were often okay with their own coverage. They worried reform might mess that up.
That's a huge political challenge for reformers, isn't it? How do you fix the system for the many without scaring the, well, the relatively satisfied few?
Exactly. That tension was central to the whole political battle.
Okay, so with that really complex backdrop, let's get into the legislative journey. It wasn't exactly smooth sailing, was it?
That's putting it mildly, a huge understatement. The push really kicked into high gear during the 2008 presidential campaign. Healthcare was central.
And there were differences even among Democrats then, right? Like on the individual mandate.
Yeah, that's interesting to look back on. Hillary Clinton supported the mandate needing everyone covered for the market to work. Obama initially opposed it, focused more on affordability. Shows the different thinking even within the party.
But then Obama wins, and he makes it priority number one.
He really did, right out of the gate. February 2009, address to Congress, he says, you know, healthcare reform cannot wait, it must not wait, and it will not wait another year. Democrats had the House, the Senate. It felt like the moment.
But even with majorities, the Senate, that was the big hurdle, wasn't it? Getting to 60 votes.
An incredibly difficult tightrope walk. Republicans were unified against it. So Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid needed every single Democrat, all 60, including the two independents who caucused with them, to break a filibuster.
Which gave huge leverage to moderates.
Huge leverage. They extracted concessions. The biggest, probably, was killing the public option, that government-run plan to compete with private insurers. That was needed to get Senator Lieberman's vote.
A big blow to progressives, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
They saw the public option as key for driving down costs. Its removal was a major compromise.
So after all that back and forth, the Senate passes its bill right before Christmas 2009. But that wasn't the end of it.
No, not at all. The plan was to merge the House and Senate bills. But then, bam, January 2010, Republicans win the special election in Massachusetts. Scott Brown.
Ted Kennedy's old seat.
Exactly. And Democrats lost their 60-vote filibuster-proof majority. That completely derailed the standard conference committee process.
But plan B, how did they get it across the finish line?
They had to get creative. The leadership decided the House would have to pass the Senate's bill, as is. Then they'd use this process called reconciliation to make some changes they'd agreed on.
Reconciliation, that's the one with different rules, right? Needs fewer votes.
Right. Simple majority in the Senate, no filibuster allowed. But it still meant intense negotiations within the House Democratic caucus. Obama even issued an executive order on abortion funding to nail down the last votes. So March 2010, the House passes the Senate bill. No Republican votes. They also passed the separate reconciliation bill, the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act. That then bounced back to the Senate and House for final approval under those reconciliation rules.
Sounds like a real political nail biter. And passing it entirely on party lines. That had major long-term effects, didn't it?
Absolutely. No bipartisan buy-in meant it lacked broad political legitimacy from day one. That fueled the intense opposition, the repeal efforts, everything that came after.
Right.
Plus, you know, needing 60 votes initially, then using reconciliation, it meant the final bill was more moderate, more compromised than many progressives wanted.
Okay, let's talk about the people behind it. Who were the key architects, the main influencers shaping this thing?
Well, obviously at the top, President Obama. He set the agenda, made it the priority. His personal story, you know, his mother's struggles with insurance while battling cancer, that was a deep motivator for him.
Right. He mentioned that often.
And he framed it both morally as a right and economically as essential for the country. He really pushed that dual message.
I remember that September 2009 speech. We are the only wealthy nation that allows such hardship.
Exactly. That captured his core argument. He also evolved on the mandate, realizing it was probably necessary.
And in Congress, key players.
Harry Reid in the Senate, absolutely crucial. Juggling those 60 votes was a monumental task.
Keeping everyone on board.
Exactly. Committee chairs, too. Max Baucus in finance led those early, ultimately unsuccessful bipartisan talks, the Gang of Six. Ted Kennedy was vital early on in HELP before he passed.
And the House side.
Key chairs like Rangel, Levin, Miller, but especially Henry Waxman at Energy and Commerce. His deep policy knowledge was just invaluable in drafting the House bill.
What about inside the administration? Key advisors whispering in the president's ear.
Oh, definitely. Peter Orszag, the OMB director, was big on the fiscal sustainability angle, pushing for delivery system reforms to bend the cost curve.
Right, the long-term budget stuff.
And Zeke Emanuel, a special advisor on health, was a major proponent of things like accountable care organizations, ways to improve quality, coordinate care, reduce costs.
So a lot of different hands stirring the pot, shaping the final bill. Stepping back, beyond the policy details, why is the ACA such a significant milestone, politically and socially?
Well, politically, it really showed both what's possible in terms of major reform in the U.S. system, but also how incredibly hard it is.
Yeah, the hurdles seem immense.
Passing it proved you could do big things, but the narrow margins, the partisanship, the procedural fights, it highlighted all the veto points in the system. It also reflects, you know, where we were in the evolution of the federal role in healthcare. It built on Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP. But stopped short of single payer working within the private insurance market.
Sort of embodies that American incrementalism, maybe. Pragmatism.
Exactly. Political scientists like Jacob Hacker call it policy layering. Building on what's already there, not a radical tear down and rebuild.
Now, obviously it's a very American law, but did they look overseas at all? Were there international influences?
Well, American exceptionalism is always strong, right? So direct copying wasn't really on the table, but policymakers were definitely aware of other systems.
Like what? Any examples?
Sure. Switzerland and the Netherlands, they use regulated private insurance with mandates. That offered a kind of model.
Okay.
Australia's approach to negotiating drug prices, Germany's risk adjustment mechanisms to keep insurance markets stable. People looked at those things.
So not direct borrowing, but maybe inspiration or ideas.
Yeah. The key takeaway was probably just that universal coverage is possible. Other wealthy countries do it. So a U.S. solution should be achievable, even if it looks different.
Okay. Let's really dig into the law itself now, the nuts and bolts. What are the absolute key provisions people need to understand about the ACA?
All right. Number one has to be the individual mandate.
The controversial one.
The very controversial one. Basically, most people had to have health insurance or face a tax penalty.
Mm-hmm.
There were exemptions, of course, financial hardship, religion, Native American tribes, incarcerated folks, income too low to file taxes.
And the politics of that were fascinating. Right? It started as a conservative idea.
Yeah, from conservative think tanks, Heritage Foundation, as a market-based alternative to employer mandates. Then Democrats picked it up. Then Republicans largely turned against it. Quite the journey.
Okay, mandate. What else? How did it make insurance affordable?
That's where the marketplace subsidies came in. Premium tax credits.
Right.
If your income was between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level, and you bought insurance through the new marketplaces, you could get help paying the premiums.
And there was help with out-of-pocket costs, too.
Yes. Cost-sharing reductions, or CSRs. For people between 100% and 250% of poverty, buying a silver plan. Lower deductibles, co-pays. Big deal for affordability.
Millions got these, right? Huge costs, though.
Tens of millions projected, yeah. CBO figured about 25 million getting tax credits by 2023, costing maybe $150 billion a year. But importantly, it cut off sharply at 400% poverty.
The cliff.
Exactly. Just above that line, some middle-income families still found coverage really expensive.
Okay, subsidies. What about Medicaid expansion? That was huge, too.
Huge. The goal was to expand Medicaid to almost all adults with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. The feds would pay almost all of it 100% at first, then phasing down to 90%.
But then the Supreme Court stepped in.
Right. 2012, the court said the expansion had to be optional for states. So some did, some didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Created this huge geographical gap in coverage.
We'll come back to that gap. What about employers? Any new rules for them?
Yes, the employer mandate. Large employers, 50 or more full-time equivalent workers, had to offer affordable minimum value coverage to their full-time employees or face penalties, built on the existing system.
Okay, mandates, subsidies, expansion. How was all this financed? Where'd the money come from?
Good question. A mix of things. New taxes, mostly on higher earners, an additional Medicare tax, a tax on net investment income.
Right.
There was the infamous Cadillac tax on high-cost employer plans, though that kept getting delayed and eventually scrapped. Limits on health FSAs, a higher threshold for deducting medical expenses.
So mostly taxes and fees.
Projected to cover about half the cost over 10 years, maybe $500 billion. The other half was supposed to come from slowing the growth of Medicare and Medicaid spending, finding efficiencies.
Interesting. Beyond coverage and financing, did it try to change how healthcare is actually delivered?
Yes, absolutely. There was funding for comparative effectiveness research figuring out what treatments work best. The Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCRI.
But they couldn't consider cost, right?
Explicitly prohibited from denying coverage based just on cost effectiveness, a political compromise. It also aimed to boost primary care higher payments, funding community health centers, supporting medical home models, trying to shift away from just fee-for-service.
Got it. And finally, the insurance market reforms. What were the big ones there?
Quite a few. Allowing young adults to stay on parents' plans until 26, that was immediate and popular.
Yeah, huge impact right away.
Banning lifetime coverage limits. Yeah. Stopping insurers from rescinding coverage unless there was fraud. Mandating preventive services vaccines. Screenings with no copays.
That preventive care piece seems important.
Very. And the medical loss ratio rule requiring insurers to spend 80 or 85 cents of every premium dollar on actual care, not overhead or profit. If they didn't, they had to send rebates.
Rebates. People like those.
And finally, a process to review big premium hikes. So, yeah, a lot of changes to how insurance worked.
Okay, that's a great overview of the core pieces. Now let's shift to the early days. 2010 to 2013, putting this massive law into practice. What were the key regulatory steps?
Oh, it was intense. HHS and other agencies had this monumental task of writing the actual rules, turning law into regulations.
Like defining essential health benefits.
Exactly. What had to be covered in those individual and small group plans? They landed on using state benchmark plans. Also, specifying those preventive services that got really contentious around contraception, leading to religious exemptions.
Right. The contraception mandate fight.
And nailing down the details of the individual mandate. What counts as coverage? Who gets exemptions? How's the penalty calculated? Just a ton of detailed work.
Meanwhile, what were doctors and hospitals doing? How did they start getting ready?
Well, many started exploring those new delivery reform models, ACOs, medical homes, trying to figure out how to work differently. Medicare's shared savings program had over 200 ACOs by 2013.
Oh, some uptake there.
Yeah. Providers also had to gear up for more quality reporting, lots of contract talks with insurers getting ready for the marketplaces, often with pressure on rates. And hospitals were trying to figure out what fewer uninsured patients might mean for their bottom line, their uncompensated care.
A mix of responses then. Some eager, some wary.
Very much so. Some embraced it, saw opportunities. Others were much more cautious, concerned about the changes.
And getting the word out. Enrolling people. That sounds like a huge job.
Massive. There were grants for community groups to help, though maybe not as much funding as hoped. States varied wildly.
Depending on whether they built their own marketplace.
Exactly. States like Oregon, Cover Oregon, Colorado, Connect for Health Colorado, they did more tailored outreach. Consumer groups, provider organizations, foundations all pitched in too, trying to educate people.
This has been incredibly complex administratively.
Any big challenges there?
Oh, yeah. Constant tension between immediate deadlines and long-term goals, technical feasibility versus political promises, and just the sheer complexity of the U.S. system, federal, state, local, plus the intense partisanship made everything harder.
But some parts did work fairly quickly and well, right?
Yeah.
Help build support.
Definitely. Those early wins, like dependent coverage to 26, banning lifetime limits, they provided tangible benefits early on. That helped. But yeah, huge obstacles remain the legal challenges, especially the Supreme Court Medicaid decision, the constant political opposition, the administrative headaches. Okay, let's move into the main event, really. The first open enrollment in 2014 and the years just after, up to 2016, that launch didn't go so well.
Oh, boy. That's the understatement of the year. The healthcare.gov launch, the federal website for dozens of states, was a disaster.
Just totally crashed.
Pretty much riddled with technical problems. Right. People couldn't create accounts, couldn't browse plans. It was awful. Inadequate testing, flawed design, not enough server capacity, poor coordination between contractors.
Yeah.
A perfect storm.
Hugely embarrassing.
Yeah.
What about the states running their own sites?
Mixed bag. Some, like Kentucky, Washington, Connecticut, did relatively okay. They'd invested more, had more control. Others, well, Oregon's Cover Oregon was an even bigger failure than the federal site. Had to be scrapped entirely.
So lots of states ended up using paper applications.
Yeah. Had to have workarounds, paper applications, call centers, working overtime, whatever it took.
But despite that nightmare start, people did eventually sign up.
They did. Once they fixed the website, which took a heroic effort and outreach continued, enrollment picked up steadily. By April 2014, end of that first open enrollment, about 8 million had marketplace plans, plus another almost 5 million new Medicaid CHIP folks.
So progress, but maybe not what was hoped initially, and varied a lot.
Yeah, significant progress, but definitely varied by state, by demographic group.
Let's talk about that Medicaid expansion again. In the states that did expand, what was the impact in those early years?
Pretty significant. Hospitals saw big drops in uncompensated care costs, which helped their finances.
Right. Fewer people showing up with no way to pay.
Exactly. Community health centers benefited, too. And studies started showing low-income adults in those states had better access, more primary care, preventive care, prescriptions. It made a difference.
But then you have the non-expansion states. What happened there? The coverage gap.
Yeah, that gap became a huge issue. People below 100% poverty, too poor for marketplace subsidies, but their state hadn't expanded Medicaid, so they didn't qualify for that either.
Right, just stuck in the middle with no affordable option.
Exactly. About 4 million people, mostly in the South, Texas, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, were big ones, a major hole in the coverage picture.
The ACA also fundamentally changed the insurance market rules. Remind us of those key shifts.
Okay, the big one. Community rating. No varying premiums based on health status anymore. Pre-existing conditions couldn't be used to deny coverage or charge more.
That's huge for people with health issues.
Massive. Premiums could still vary by age within limits, location, family size, tobacco use, but not health. It made the individual market look more like the employer market, reduced that job lock problem.
Where you stay in a job just for the insurance.
Right. Then the MLR rules kicked in, forcing insurers to spend more on care. And the EHB requirement set that floor for comprehensive benefits.
What about provider networks? That became a big topic, right? Narrow networks?
Yeah, definitely. To keep premiums down on the marketplaces, many insurers offered plans with narrow networks, fewer doctors, fewer hospitals.
Which could mean trouble accessing specialists.
It could, yeah. Access issues were a real concern. How states regulated network adequacy varied a lot. And people complained constantly about inaccurate provider directories. You couldn't tell who was actually in your network.
Frustrating. And what about consolidation? Were hospitals merging? Insurers getting bigger?
Definitely saw trends towards consolidation on both sides. More hospital mergers, bigger insurers buying smaller ones.
Good or bad?
Debated,
yeah.
Potential for efficiency, maybe better care coordination, but big concerns about reduced competition leading to higher prices, especially with hospitals getting more negotiating power. Insurer consolidation effects were maybe a bit more ambiguous.
So big picture, 2014, 2016, impact on coverage and access. What's the summary?
Clear gains in coverage. Marketplace enrollment grew over 12 million selections by early 2016, about 10.4 million paid up by year end. Medicaid expansion added over 15 million by then. Big drops in the uninsured rate.
What costs?
That was a flip side. Many people, even with insurance, saw rising out-of-pocket costs, higher deductibles especially, both marketplace and employer plans.
So more coverage, but maybe not always affordable care.
A persistent tension. The ACA did boost value-based payment experiments, offered more financial protection against catastrophic costs. But overall, national health spending kept rising, just maybe a bit slower than projected before the law.
And quality initiatives. any results yet.
Things like PQRS, the physician quality reporting, became mandatory. PCRI started funding research, but tangible impacts on overall quality across the system. Still early days by 2016.
It sounds like just a period of massive adjustment. Mm. Successes in coverage, definitely, but ongoing challenges with cost, markets, implementation.
That sums it up well. Constant adjustments, fixes like extending enrollment periods, tweaking rules, limited bipartisan tweaks happened too, like delaying the Cadillac tax. But mostly, it was the Obama administration managing this huge, complex rollout amidst constant opposition.
We saw premiums start to rise more significantly around 2016 too.
Yeah, 2015 increases were modest, but 2016 saw bigger jumps in many markets. Insurers were still figuring out the new risk pools. Mechanisms like reinsurance helped initially, but were temporary. Risk adjustment was ongoing but complex. Insurer participation fluctuated too.
And employer insurance, did that change much?
Offer rates stayed high, actually. Didn't see the predicted drop-off. But cost sharing kept shifting to employees' higher deductibles, co-pays, more wellness programs too.
Who was still uninsured by then?
Demographics shifted a bit. Still younger, more likely male, minority. Big concentration of low-income folks in those non-expansion states. More rural residents often had fewer choices.
Did access measures improve overall, seeing doctors getting meds?
Generally, yes. More people reported having a usual source of care, getting preventive services, better medication adherence, slightly better mental health access. But those provider directory and network adequacy problems persisted.
And the delivery system reforms ACOs, bundled payments, making headway.
ACOs kept growing. Bundled payments showed some early promising results for specific procedures. Hospital value-based purchasing was evolving. But challenges remain aligning incentives, figuring out patient attribution, administrative burden. It's slow work changing how care is delivered.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot to cover on the early years.
It really is a period of massive upheaval and change in American healthcare.
Well, that brings us toward the end of this part of our deep dive on the Affordable Care Act. It's incredibly clear this law has a long, tangled history, and its effects are still rippling through the system today.
Absolutely. You said it earlier, deeply polarizing, but undeniably transformative. And it's not static, right? It keeps evolving with political and economic shifts.
We've really tried to trace that today, the complex origins going back decades, that intense legislative fight, the core pieces aimed at coverage and market reform, and then those initial years of implementation, the successes and the significant challenges.
Yeah, we've seen how it tackled those long-standing issues of access, affordability, made huge progress, expanding coverage, no doubt, millions gained insurance. But it also hit major roadblocks in the debates about cost, effectiveness, sustainability. They're obviously still very much alive.
So for our final provocative thought for you, the listener, to chew on, given everything we've discussed, the history, the politics, the nitty-gritty policy details, the messy reality of implementation, what single aspect of the ACA's design or its rollout do you think has had the most significant unintended consequence, good or bad, and why? Something to think about. We definitely encourage you to keep exploring the sources and following the continuing story of American healthcare.